Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Tim Van Loan. Tim started working with animals as a junior docent at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum in middle school, and immediately knew he wanted to spend his career sharing close relationships with animals. After graduating with a BS in biology from the University of Puget Sound, he moved across country to work at Walt Disney World as a marine mammal intern, and then later a behavioral husbandry assistant at Disney's Animal Kingdom. Throughout his career, he has been lucky enough to work around the country as a bird trainer, show leader, and behavioral husbandry manager through opportunities provided by Natural Encounters Incorporated. As of last year, he accepted a full-time position with the New Mexico Biopark Society, fulfilling the role he was already serving in as a consultant, as the behavioral manager, husbandry manager of the ABQ Biopark. The biopark consists of a zoo, bugarium, botanic garden, heritage farm, aquarium, and natural forested lands along the banks of the Rio Grande. So it has truly made dreams of improving the lives of all types of animals come true. Tim is a certified professional animal trainer and bird trainer, that's K-A-C-P-A-T and K-A-C-P-B-T, through the IATCB, and a member of the Board of Directors for the Animal Behaviour Management Alliance. He's also a graduate of Dr. Susan Freeman's Behaviour Works, Learning and Living with Animals, and the brand new How Research Works courses. So without further ado, it's my very, very great pleasure to welcome back, this is your first time, welcome for the first time, to the show today, Tim, who's patiently waiting by in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tim, thanks so much for making the time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy.
No, of course, Ryan, thank you. I am so excited to be here. And you know, even though it isn't again, for us, it is again. You know, it's been a long time since we've seen each other, but I'm really excited to be here to talk with you again and get to see you virtually.
Yeah, it's not often enough that I get to create podcast episodes with people that I've had the pleasure of spending time with in person. And you and I, out of most of the guests, have probably spent longer together, nearly living on top of each other in a motel in Dallas, Texas in 2012, I think, at the State Fair of Texas. So that was a ton of fun, and nearly a decade has passed.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I'm going to rely on you for the exact dates because I am no good with that. But the experience you described perfectly, you know, that's what I remember too. A lot of bird training and a lot of fun.
And at the time you were working with Natural Encounters Incorporated, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that and all of the other great experience that we just read about in your bio. You've definitely leveraged great opportunities and seemingly from your bio got to surround yourself with some great organizations, great communities, and great people. So I'm excited to learn more.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I feel very fortunate for everyone and everything I've encountered in my professional career.
And I'm excited to share these stories that you're going to share with us today and your knowledge and your experience with our Animal Training Academy audience. So let's dive in. First question today, Tim, we ask everyone this. I love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys. So I was wondering if you could take us back and share where you got started. Where you first learned about positive reinforcement. Was it in Arizona? Was it after Arizona? And share some stories with us from that time.
No, that's a great place to start. So in my, you know, in what you described of my life, you mentioned working at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum. And so that's the first time I ever really encountered working with animals in a professional setting. But also, I didn't grow up with any kind of pets or animals around my house. So it was really my first experience with animals in general, beyond a lot of reading and, you know, watching of TV programs, because that's really where my interest started. Living in the middle of the desert, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona. Not being near the ocean, that was actually my first interest, was the ocean and ocean animals. So I think the lack of all of that in Arizona made it so I really wanted to pursue getting to understand animals and nature better. But so at the Desert Museum, in particular, I always think of this parrot, one of the first parrots I ever interacted with, whose name was Elsie, because he was a lilac-crowned parrot. And not having any really experience with parrots or animals, when I was being taught how to interact with him and how to step him up, you know, common practice of asking a parrot to maybe step up on your hand or a perch, I was told you take the stick that he's going to step up on and you just push it into his belly. And then, you know, eventually he's going to step up onto that stick. And then, you know, you go about, you know, whatever you need, if he's going to be crated or go out to interact with guests. And so for me at the time, I remember thinking it was very interesting to me that clearly this animal didn't necessarily want to step up onto the stick when I would be asking it, but he eventually would. And I didn't really make any connections about, you know, what could be done better. I just kind of followed the guidance of my leaders at the time, because I was only, I think I was 15 or 14 at the time. But in a kind of very weird turn of events, and maybe I'm skipping forward a little bit here, I did end up actually working at the Desert Museum a little bit later in life. And so it was kind of this full circle experience with Elsie, because going back, and that was after I had been lucky enough to be exposed to a lot of behavior knowledge, I actually got to go back and voluntarily train Elsie to step up on a stick, you know, step up on the stick voluntarily, completely all the time, with no need to ever push that behavior with him. So while I didn't necessarily know it in the moment when I was first meeting Elsie and learning about, you know, how to step him up, that interaction really did lead to this moment of realization about what behavior really is all about. And so I think, yeah, back at the Desert Museum, that's really where that passion was, founded and fostered. And from there, I was, you know, again, was lucky enough to have people around me who pushed me to kind of go out and find what it is I wanted to do and other people who were just as passionate as me. And so through schooling, I was able to connect with, you know, professors and other students who shared those passions. But then it really was when I went on to be an intern at Disney World that I, again, met professionals who fostered that love of learning and directed it towards behavior. And so that's really, I think, where it all began, was in Tucson, Arizona, wanting to be near ocean animals and interacting with Elsie and kind of seeing one way of approaching behavior, and then eventually getting to go back and find a better way to do it. Because that's, what I learned. If you're going to learn the foundation of behavior, it's that you always are going back and doing better than we did before. So,
So was that part of your wanting to go back to the desert park? Was you literally wanted to go back and find a better way of doing what you had done in the past?
You know, I don't know that I knew that in the moment, but that was one of my first questions, was, is Elsie still here? Because that bird left such an impression on me, because there was so much I enjoyed about interacting with him. That was the one piece of it that I didn't necessarily enjoy, was having to push through those moments and ask him to step up. So I think part of the reason to go back was because they're so focused on animals, why not be able to add that final layer of giving our animals the choice to decide when they, you know, what they want to do, when they want to do it, and to empower our animals to be their best selves. And also, being from Tucson, and the Desert Museum is kind of, it's a very well-known spot there in Tucson. It also felt very, I've said full circle a few times, but it felt very full circle to come back to kind of my hometown zoo, you know, with which I've always loved, which I grew up going to and loving, and to, yeah, end up there again. That was enough for me in a sense. But then the icing on top of that was the fact that LC was still there, and that I was able to, yeah, go back and interact with him in that way.
I also ended up working at my hometown zoo, so I can understand and appreciate that feeling. As you were saying then, I'm reminded of stories that Ken Ramirez shared about going back and working with individual animals and they seemingly remembered him. I'm not sure of Alcy's exposure to you at that young time. Do you think, when you saw Alcy for the first time, what was that interaction like? What happened?
Yeah, you know, I went back and saw him for the first time?
Yeah.
You know, I think I was more apprehensive than he was because, you know, my memory, I didn't quite know how he was going to respond. And in my mind, you know, I guess the stepping up experience was the forefront of our experiences together for me, was thinking of those moments that were kind of tough for me because I didn't quite know what to do at that age when, you know, he wasn't wanting to step up, but I was told to behave in a certain way. So when I saw him for the first time, you know, he was a bird that really, all of his behaviors indicate he enjoys human interaction. So things like feathers flaring, eyes pinning, which I know in an Amazon can be excitement or, you know, maybe something different. But it was very clear with him, the fact that, you know, I think me as a human, there was some benefit to that interaction for him. And it actually, sorry to jump in again, there was this eventual moment where I, you know, I took him out into our weathering yard where, you know, we had a space for him to go out and kind of explore. And I had sat down on the ground, and when I wasn't looking, he'd come down off the perch. And when I looked back up, he was standing right in front of me. And I think, you know, in a moment of reading his behavior, if I let all of our past experiences, I would have been very fearful of why is this Amazon approaching me in that way, especially on the ground. Anyone who thinks of parrots being on the ground is probably not always the place you want them to be. But he walked right up to me, climbed onto my lap, and climbed right onto my hand. And I think it was, again, this moment of, wow, I feel like we have made this connection through building trust and building this step-up behavior in a completely different way. Because, of course, it then went beyond the step-up behavior. You know, we worked on a lot of other things. But just by learning to have that trusting relationship through positive reinforcement with LC, I mean, yeah, I got to experience a couple moments of realizing just the impact it had on him as an individual.
It's a beautiful story, and I like the lessons that you've shared and you've taken away from it. We talk about ripples from humans on this show, but Alcy's ripples are the ones we're learning about in today's episode. What was interesting to me is that you said what was interesting to you was watching what happened when that stick was pushed into Alcy. Now, as we said at the start of this episode, I had the pleasure of hanging out with Tim for 6 weeks. You guys can't see Tim. You can only hear him now, but he's sat here with this massive smile on his face as he talks. He's laughing right now. And these positions that we shared in your bio and these organizations and these communities that you've been involved with there, you know, not everyone can just walk in and land positions and get those opportunities. And I do feel a big part of that, Ryan's offering his personal opinion here, is Tim Van Loan and the outlook you have on life and your positive energy and your positive outlook. This way of framing that part earlier, I want to focus on this, and sorry, it's weird that I'm picking out this one little thing, but you're saying it's interesting to you, that was interesting to you. As a 15-year-old, was curiosity part of who you were now, and how important has that approach been to your journey?
Wow, I love that question. Yeah, I think curiosity was, I guess, could you call it a skill? Is curiosity a skill or is it an attribute? I mean, it was an attribute.
It's a label, Tim.
A label, right. Yeah, what does curiosity look like? Well, I can tell you what it looked like for me. It started with my parents, definitely. I mean, my parents have no, how do I say this nicely? They have no animal bones in their body. And so, you know, they, that being said, they saw the passion I had and they told me that they would support me in finding the direction I wanted to take. But that direction was only up to me. And that applied to a lot of things in my life beyond just my interests. But I think specifically when it came to finding where I belonged, who I belonged with, what I was interested in, and, you know, even more specifically than just animals and nature, being interested in helping animals and changing behavior for the positive, that all came from, yeah, my upbringing and having my parents say that I was responsible for my own outcome, you know, my own fate, if you want to say it that way. And so I think that's also maybe sometimes to a, you know, detrimental degree, but I kind of enter most situations with this very positive, outgoing outlook on life. And that has really, I think, even in moments where I didn't quite know where I was going or where I needed to end up, somehow I feel like I've always ended up where I was supposed to because of that. So I love that you picked up on that, because I don't know that I would have thought of that initial, you know, boost for my parents to really be curious and explore anything I was interested in. Yeah, I often wonder how I ended up where I am, but I think that is one really identifiable factor that led here.
Well, I love that we went there. I think when I ask that question, like, tell us where you got started, people often think back to that first place of employment, but really we all got started a lot earlier than that in life. Being provided with antecedents and consequences from the time we were born. So I didn't know that about you. I love learning that about you, and it helps me appreciate you even more. Can you share, so that, I'm going to butcher the name now, Eliza was the name of the bird? Elsie. I knew I'd butchered it. Elsie.
And it's actually lilac crown parrot, like Elsie, just literally the letters. Yeah, I don't think there's not much creativity involved in that name. But
hey,
yeah.
Like, not like the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I mean, we're full of creative names here. Hey, can you share any other pivotal moments? I mean, you've been Disney Animal Kingdom and the other Disney park, and now you're at the biopark. What other, has there been any other pivotal moments / animals learners that have kind of shaped who you are today?
Definitely. I mean, so at Disney's Animal Kingdom, you know, I think this is where surrounding yourself with people who are going to push you, whether you know it or not, is so important to finding your passion. And so for me, one of those people was Marty McPhee, who is still currently employed there. And she was my supervisor when I was the behavioral husbandry assistant. And she's a person that, and I'm sure you have mentors like this in your life, Ryan, who pushed me to grow my knowledge and network and meet new people and ask for opportunities without actually pushing me to do so. You know, Marty would always casually suggest things, find things for me to explore on my own. Hey, there's that curiosity thing again. You know, she really tapped into that for me, to the point that that's how I thought I had happened upon the job posting for Natural Encounters myself. But when I look back at the situation, it was actually Marty that led me there. And, you know, I think that was a pretty amazing step, again, in leading me towards not just being passionate about animals, but being passionate about the best lives possible for our animals and realizing we're in control of that in the scenarios we're in. So, you know, not necessarily a specific situation, but a very specific person who, I don't really know where I'd be if Marty hadn't led me down the path to Natural Encounters and meeting Steve Martin, because that was really a pivotal moment in learning where I wanted to go.
We'll come back to that. Steve Martin has been a guest on the show before. You can go back in our library and listen to an episode from him, as well as numerous members of the NEI team, current and past. I thought it was funny that you said your parents had no animal bones in them. I thought, what are these, slugs?
Oh, see, I thought I was saying it nicely, but now you've just taken it a whole different direction. Yeah,
it's weird where my brain goes sometimes. Hey, what I also like that you said there, that what they provided for you was the context that and outcomes and consequences that you were then responsible for your own outcome. They gave you that gift. It made me think as you were saying that that's what we do. That's what we do with our learners now. Would you say that that's what you want your learners to feel, that they are responsible for their own outcomes? And has that kind of bled into?
Definitely. I mean, I often say to the staff I work with that in my ideal world, I'm obsolete. That, you know, what I do and what I coach people on and the knowledge I try to share with them are all things that they could find on their own, could be approaching on their own. And so I guess, you know, I don't want my job to go away. I don't want my position to go away. But in this idealistic world, I would love for everybody to have the time and the passion to approach these topics, in their own way, which, you know, I think the most successful interactions I have with people are with those people who have run with it a little bit, you know, who've taken some element of training, behavior, welfare, and they find what motivates them and motivates their passion, and they take that and, you know, they expound on it on their own. I think we can think of a million different examples in the animal world, human world, about learning, where, you know, people are forced to learn, or, you know, there's no choice in the situation, much less likely to want to feel passionate about it. And that's really what it's all about, especially with animals. You know, I think we all are working with animals because we're passionate about them. And so we should find what sparks that passion and really foster it and cherish it.
Lovely. You said Steve Martin was a big influence on you, as he has been for me. I think my guidance towards Crucial Conversation, which was a life-changing piece of content and one that I leverage and use within our community every week. I attribute that back. Steve Martin was the first person to tell me about that. So his ripples within the Animal Training Academy community I felt on a daily basis. What was it about your interaction and your meeting of Steve Martin that I think you said kind of cemented the direction you wanted to go and the focus that you wanted? What you've just talked about? What was it and kind of what happened after meeting Steve Martin and starting to work for NEI?
Yeah, I mean, it's great that I love Crucial Conversations, and Steve was the one who introduced it to me. And I think, you know, when I started working, so after I met Steve, it was at an interview at the ranch in Florida where NEI is based. And I started there as a seasonal. And I think what was so amazing to me, I'd come from Disney, you know, very corporate and very structured, with very specific rules for everything, but with no real room for anyone to interpret or question. And so going into Steve's environment, the NEI environment, Steve, I mean, it's so powerful that what he has created there, the culture he has created there, that it doesn't have to operate on those strict standards and rules that corporations do, but it's still, because it doesn't, it fosters this environment of growth and passion and community. You know, and that's probably for any job, whether it's animals or no matter what you do, the community that supports you is why you're able to do what you do well. And so I think going in as a new employee and seeing the environment that is created, the work culture that exists at Natural Encounters, I was too naive at the time to realize that's not how it is everywhere, but I was wise enough to realize how special it was to be there in that culture myself, if that makes sense.
No, having spent that time, as we talked about, with Natural Encounters myself, I've also experienced that and can relate to what you're saying and some of the experiences that we shared together. How many times did you do the Birds of the World show? Share with people about what the Birds of the World show is. I realize we're talking about it without actually explaining to people what we're talking about.
Right. No, kind of, if you just describe it in the way we did, it sounds like this kind of chaotic, you know, amalgamation of what feathers and people and who knows what, you know, fair. But yeah, so, I mean, Steve and Natural Encounters have had been doing the State Fair of Texas for over 25 years. And then just recently they started going back to the State Fair of Texas again. So I think they've now been there for a total of 26 or 27 years. So for me, I was able to go twice as a full-time employee at the fair itself. And so the experience is, I mean, it's like unlike any other. It starts, you know, long before the State Fair of Texas starts itself, way back at the ranch, the Natural Encounters Ranch, and with training all of the birds and all of the, you know, maybe some staff who are going to be going with to the State Fair. And so then when we actually go to the State Fair, which involves taking all of those birds, taking all of the equipment we need to go with those birds to the State Fair, taking all the food we need, I mean, just all of the logistics to get birds and people all the way from Orlando to Dallas, Texas, that in itself is a feat. But then once we would arrive at the fair, then it was a 2-month kind of process of putting everything together, helping all the training, making all the training happen in that space. And, you know, for me, besides just the way it all comes together, one of the most important pieces that I loved was where you came in, Ryan, which is all of the interns that would help with the State Fair show. And so beyond just the Natural Encounters staff who would be present, there would be, I mean, groups of 10 to maybe 15 interns. And the term intern here applied in a lot of different ways. You know, sometimes it's your kind of traditional person who's just starting out with an interest in the field, who wants to understand what a bird show on the road is like. But then there are tons of different professionals that would come from organizations around the world to experience what it's like to be in that microcosm of Natural Encounters at the State Fair. And so, yeah, we do shows for like 30 days straight once the fair opened. And, you know, we'd be exhausted every single day, but loving getting up again at 7 a.m. to go right back and do the same thing over again. But of course, as we all know, working with animals, it's never the same thing over again. Just the routine maybe is. But yeah, so 30 days of nonstop shows and socializing with all these great professionals from around the world. And then at the end of it all, what took us, you know, maybe a month lead up to get there, we would take it all apart in about a week and head off back to Florida and hopefully leave people and our interns better than they were before. You know, I think, like you said, it's a way for all different people to experience what it's like to exist in that culture of Natural Encounters.
So how many have you done? Was it just?
It was two that I've worked, and then I was lucky enough to get to go to the 25th year. I was there for a short while. But at that point, I was already working here in Albuquerque, so I wasn't able to take the time away to go work at it.
What's your favorite State Fair of Texas Birds of the World show moment?
Oh, wow. Well, that's so... And you'll have to share whether, you know, what you got to do at this point. But one of the traditions of the fair show was the very last show. You know, Steve would do every single show during the State Fair, all of the talking, you know, all of the onstage work. But then the very last show, each of the interns and staff that had been working would get assigned a different portion of the show that they could go out and do themselves. And so my first time ever being on stage, talking on a microphone, training a bird simultaneously was getting to go out and do the owl routine with a Eurasian eagle owl who'd fly out over the audience. And I got to select two people to come up onto stage and sit, you know, in front of the stump, and the owl flies right over their head. So for me, that is always such a standout memory because the bowl or the amphitheater that the show occurs in, I mean, it can fit, you know, a couple thousand people at maximum. And so, you know, it's a big, big stage to be standing on for the first time, but it's also just so exhilarating. Did you happen to get to do a part of the show, Ryan?
Yeah, mine included the Eurasian Eagle Owl as well and walking out with one of those on the glove at the end and having all the people come through. And I think I turned to Steve at the moment. I said, Steve, this is like the coolest thing I've ever done. And he's like, really? And I was like, yeah, really. Like, this is a pivotal moment in my career to be standing. I mean, I'm from New Zealand on a stage in Texas with this eagle owl on my arm with all of these, like you say, thousands of people in that space coming up. So I can definitely relate to that feeling and why you chose that moment. Hey, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, everyone who's been to the State Fair of Texas, though, will be calling me a liar if I don't say that the actual best part is probably all of the food, right? Like all of the different types of fair food that you can experience. Yeah, it's all the different kinds of food you can experience and can look at but don't need to experience, right? So, like, yeah, deep fried ice cream, deep fried butter. All of those deep things you never knew. Deep fried beer. Yeah.
I think they won the year that we were there. Best fair food.
Did it. You know, I think I remember deep fried Thanksgiving dinner, you know, very American specific, but I think that was maybe the year after you were there. That was the winning thing. Yeah. So it's funny how they pick that.
Yeah. And you said it was, people might think of chaos when they hear the Birds of the World show. I have great videos of Tim and I, the Birds of the World show, everyone. I'm not going to share them. They're young us. But there's one, I think you're in it, Tim, where one of the crown cranes flies off and we go to get it. And it's just flying just out of the arena and there's kids kind of around it. And then we had black uniforms that year. And everyone was wearing earpieces. So I have this video of people in black uniforms with earpieces surrounding this ground crane. And it's just calmly walking back into the arena and then going back into its own space. But it's so funny. It looks like the Secret Service have come in to pick up the band. Hey, not sure if you're active on social media, but can you tell people where they can go to find out more about the Albuquerque Zoo or follow you on social if you're on social?
Totally. So we are called the ABQ Biopark. So you'll be able to find all of our social media, Facebook, Instagram, under ABQ Biopark. I am also on social media as Tim Van Loan on both Facebook and Instagram. It's interesting the way that social media has changed, you know, our experience with behavior and the way we can connect our public to what we're doing. So, yeah, I think I would hope that if anyone who's listening goes out to, especially to maybe our YouTube page, there's a series called Vitamin Z that we produced during the pandemic. I think it's 10 episodes where I'm the host of it. And it was a great chance. We took the opportunity. We saw the pandemic as an opportunity and seized it as a chance to help our audience and the ABQ Biopark community learn more about what the care is that goes into our animals. So especially while we were shut down, it was a really awesome chance to talk about enrichment and training and welfare in a very casual, light sense and way that hopefully gave, you know, our community a more in-depth understanding of what actually happens every day at the biopark. So yeah, anyone who wants to go check that out, Vitamin Z, ABQ Biopark. I was going to give my favorite episodes, you know, but I don't want to make any of the other ones feel lesser, but you know, like the Heritage Farm, we have a really special area at the biopark that is all, it's all New Mexico heritage breeds. And so there's an episode all about the care that goes into the chickens and the sheep and the horses and the steer that live out there. As well as I think the elephant episode, really showcases the passion that our keepers have, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who are driving our work with our animals. And so I love being able to help showcase the work that all these passionate individuals are doing at the biopark.
Awesome. Well, we'll link to that in the show notes. I'll be checking it out. Maybe we'll share one of those videos on the write-up as well. Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Tim. As mentioned, we love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, so we're grateful for everything that you've shared with us. Moving forward, as mentioned, I love stories. I love teaching through stories. I love learning through story. And we're in for a treat because you've prepared some for us. One thing I was going to say that you mentioned to me, you know, when we caught up a few weeks ago, and something that you said is really important to you, is that you're drawn towards learners, human and non-humans, who are possibly not getting the attention you feel they deserve. And I love that this is what you want to talk about. Can you share with everyone listening five stories you've picked from your experience, where this has been the case?
Yeah, no, I definitely can. You know, I think we are learning more every single day. I mean, that's the human experience, is daily learning. But I think in the animal world, learning that there is a better way is also a constant to being an animal professional. And so, when I first came to the biopark, I was really drawn to, species and people who maybe, weren't used to having positive reinforcement techniques utilized with them or encouraged with them. And so one of those examples was with a little guinea pig named Carlos. And Carlos was extremely geriatric, and he had some eye issues when I first met him. And the reason I think he is the perfect, he's like the epitome of this whole conversation, is that, a guinea pig, especially geriatric, is small enough that pretty much any care you could need to do with a guinea pig, especially medically, could be done, quickly restrained with no voluntary aspect to it whatsoever. And I think often people justify those situations because of the speed at which they can occur in that given moment. Or again, because you can pick them up and it's just easy to not even think about giving Carlos the choice over his environment and the control to say yes or no to whether he wants to participate. But so his keepers, he was one of the first animals they brought to my attention, which is so interesting because they work in our education department. I think they have, over 90 different animals in their collection they work with. But for whatever reason, Carlos and his eye issue was something they brought up to me. And so we started discussing, well, how can we give Carlos back quality of life? And I mentioned his eye problem earlier. That was really the sticking point for the team, was that, every day they were restraining him to give him eye drops. And so his keeper team, who at the time was actually, we don't call them interns, we call them seasonals or temporary staff, but it was two temporary keepers. I'd mentioned, well, what if we gave him a space where he then would understand that's where we were going to work with him, that's where we're going to train with him, and that's where all kind of medical procedures are going to occur. And I left it with them. When I came back the next week, they had built what I call the Carlos Evita balcony, and it was from his little enclosure. They actually built this wooden, literally balcony that came out from the entrance such that we could put it right up to his enclosure, open the door, and he could step out onto that balcony himself. Now, beyond that, they decided to take it to the next level and look at those eye drops and start training those eye drops voluntarily on that platform. And I mean, it was amazing, Ryan, the speed at which Carlos learned. Even though he didn't really have much experience being a positive reinforcement learner in his entire life, once he understood the concept of, my behavior influences the reinforcers, he was so eager to get out onto that balcony and to turn his little head up and to offer his eyeball so that the eye drops could be put in. And, I don't mean to be too sad or down, but Carlos did eventually pass away. But what I think is so beautiful about his story is that, the day before he passed away, he walked onto that balcony and got his eye drops voluntarily. And he hadn't had to be restrained until that very last day. And so just to think of the change in his life in the last little bit of his life as an older guinea pig, how important to him that was, and the changes his keepers saw in him, the fact that he would run up to them when they would walk up to the enclosure, the fact that he would solicit getting scratches from them all of a sudden, all these little signs to them that his outlook on the way he interacted with his environment had changed. I mean, that's just so powerful to me, especially being this little tiny guinea pig that, us as humans could easily prioritize our convenience over his welfare, but choosing not to do that and giving that choice back to him. I mean, that was a really powerful moment for me and for his keepers too. I think they also saw the effects that it had on this one animal, and it was kind of a springboard for them to then see the way they could make small differences, small changes to the lives of their animals in their collection, especially because they have so many, that, they could make little differences in their animals' lives just by flipping kind of the script on how they normally would think about approaching this animal's care.
I love that. It reminded me, we've got a video we made years ago, which took the last question of this podcast show. what do you want to see happen in the next 5 to 10 years? We took 75 episodes at the time and turned it into a 12 and a half minute segment. But there's a trainer called Ava Bertelsson in there from Sweden who basically just said, how can we change the life for each individual? How can we make each individual's life better? And it sounds like there was Carlos is such a beautiful, giving Carlos choice, as you called it, as we've named the story. I don't know if here on the spot or if it's something you'd already named. Giving Carlos choice on his magical, what did you call it? Balcony?
Yeah, his magical balcony.
Magical balcony of husbandry.
Yeah.
Eye drops aren't an easy behavior to train. So, they did remarkably well.
Yeah. No, they really did. And I love that what you mentioned about affecting every individual, because I think that statement is so powerful, and we need to treat it with care, because we need to give every individual the attention that they deserve and the choice and power they deserve in every moment of their life. For my staff, you know, I when I say things like that, especially as new learners, maybe, of this kind of methodology I'm encouraging, it can feel very overwhelming. And, you know, it can be kind of defeating if you say, well, you need to be influencing every individual in your care. That can feel very, yeah, people can get downtrodden, down and hard on themselves very quickly if they feel like you're saying that in a way that, is derogatory towards what they're doing. But instead, what I try to tell them when they get upset over that is, yeah, think of the one animal you can affect today. And then tomorrow, think of the one animal you can affect tomorrow, and make approximations with it, you know, just like we do with any behavior. And don't be hard on yourself if you don't get to access that one animal today or those couple animals today. Make your plan for tomorrow such that you do, and build from there. So I love that thought of affecting every individual and doing it in the right way for that individual and for the person who's in control.
Well, I love that you brought it back to taking approximations, celebrating approximations. Thank you, Susan, for that one. Something we talk about a lot on within Animal Training Academy, not just on the podcast show. Now, giving Carlos choice on his magical balcony of husbandry was the first the first animal that you worked with this team at
yeah,
Albuquerque. But you'd already been working there as a consultant, or was this when you were a consultant?
This was when I was a consultant, way back in the very beginning of me arriving there.
And I love that you brought up overwhelm. We did a Facebook post in our members group recently, and it was just an image that just said, "Are you overwhelmed?" And it got so many comments and sharing, brave sharing from our community. You mentioned that, you got to be careful. You got to treat that with care, because we could imply that if you're not doing that, then you're not a good person. Obviously, resources and team and support from management are things that listeners of this podcast show are unique to each and every individual situation. What do you have to say to someone who might be in a position wanting to make changes like this, but struggling a little bit?
Yeah, I think for me, I always try to, and this can be really difficult, but I try to parse apart what do I actually have control over and what don't I have control over. And then beyond what do I have control over, it's what do I have the reasonable ability to affect today. You know, and I break down my time into chunks that work so I don't get overwhelmed, but create movement forward. And on some days, that's seconds at a time. And on some days, that's hours and maybe days and maybe a week at a time. But I think that would be what I would suggest, is find the amount of time that works for you and that you are able to operate in without getting overwhelmed. And then think about what you can actually change and what you can control. And maybe that's just one thing today. Maybe today, all you're going to do differently is, you know, change one thing about the way you're interacting with this animal in your life or with this person in your life. And build from there. Take that first step and celebrate the approximation of successfully doing that, and then add another layer to it. And pretty soon it won't seem so overwhelming. But I know that's a feeling I still struggle with sometimes, you know, even though I've been in this same role now for a while. It's a day at a time, a minute at a time, whatever it needs to be to help me be effective. Because if we aren't being kind enough to ourselves and easy enough on ourselves, then our animals are definitely not going to be getting the best care possible. They're not going to be getting the best versions of us if we can't manage our own selves the best way possible. So don't get so overwhelmed that it affects your animals. Yeah.
Love it. Hey, I realized that I could ask many more questions and we wouldn't even get on to story two. So let's push on because you got four more gems for us. What can follow given Carlos' choice?
Yeah, so we have like you mentioned, a few different areas to the biopark, and the zoo, with the zoo being one of them. And the zoo contains an area where our cats and carnivores have some of their housing. That's the oldest part of the zoo, and in fact, there's an exhibit that has an animal in it has a tiger in it. That the keeper, who's currently working there, her grandfather worked in that same exact tiger exhibit 50 years ago. Not with the same animal, obviously, but in that same environment. Clearly, things have changed very differently, even if this exhibit itself hasn't changed. But it's easy to let the fact that age of these exhibits be the limiting factor on any interaction, positive or negative, with our animals. And so that's what I kind of walked into when I got to the biopark. Was this area was kind of thought of as, oh, well, it's these old exhibits, these old holding areas. There's not much we can really do with these animals. And that had kind of reflected onto the keepers themselves. And so it was interesting because when I first arrived, actually, I think the very first training task I was given was to help do a voluntary injection with our male lion in one of these very old exhibits. And with a keeper who had never done a voluntary injection before. What I had come to find out, though, is there had been a lot of talk about doing voluntary injections and the need for that to happen. And so there had been a lot of pressure built up on the keeper that this needed to be happening, but with no real infrastructure for how to successfully make it happen. And then, of course, that reflect on the fact that the lion, his care was not at the maximum best level possible because of all the pressure that was built up on this keeper. So this is kind of twofold, because for the keeper, all it really took was having someone there to believe in them, right? And to support their success. And it was a good learning opportunity for me, because even in moments where I could see the success in the behavior we were getting out of from Kenya, the lion, it was hard for the keeper to see those approximations themselves. And so it really took supporting the behavior by supporting the person who was training it to get to the point where Kenya was actually able to be successfully voluntarily injected. But I think it was such a lesson in labels, right? Labeling this area as old, you know, unable to be trained in, all of these, you know, these labels about these old exhibits, and the way that labels can then kind of trickle down onto the animals themselves and the people who are in those spaces. And so I think unlabeling the area, finding the space to do the training in, and then unlabeling the animal and the keeper are what really were the keys to success in the end. It wasn't anything about, I mean, of course, there were the techniques that went into the training project itself, but I think the success of, you know, empowering both the person and the animal really came down to, yeah, being supportive, not actually about, you know, any specific behavior technique we used in the training. And it was really, I think the fruition of that that's really beautiful is that now all of our cats in that area, all of our carnivores in that area can be voluntarily injected, and we're working on voluntary blood draws from the tail with almost every, you know, with a lot of the animals in that area. And if we're not working on it, we're looking on how to do it. Because once we had that one success, that one unlabeling of nothing can happen in this area, people started seeing the opportunities that existed there. Even though it was the same exact setups they've been looking at for years and years, that had existed for 50 years, all of a sudden the possibilities, not all the things that stood in their way, were what were visible.
I love stories like that. It always reminds me of that. I can't remember who it was. This is a terrible recollection of actual factual events. But there was a world record on running that couldn't be broken. Like, it couldn't be broken. And it stood for quite a long time, years, until someone broke it. And then suddenly everyone broke it. It was like just that mental hurdle was so significant, seemingly. You said all of this keeper needed was someone to believe in him. I wonder if I'm interpreting that correctly, as all that keeper needed is someone to reinforce behavior towards the end outcome. Is that, would you see it the same way? Were you reinforcing what behavior, like, were you looking for, or could you recommend for others to look for in moving towards a goal that might share similarities to this one?
Yeah, well, it's really tough when you are given a task and no guidance, you know, something you've never been tasked with before, and then no guidance on the steps in between. And so I think I love that, the way you just frame that, and reinforcing each behavior along the way in the keeper to get to the point where the voluntary injection could occur. And so I think it is finding the little things, like we do in, you know, as we're observing behavior, that tell us what our animal's body language is telling us. And so it's watching, standing back and watching people do what they do, and reinforcing the things that they already have within them. Because that's why I said, you know, he only needed someone to believe in him, is because he had the ability to work. You know, he has been working with big cats for longer, you know, a long, long time. I don't know the exact amount of time, but 20 plus years. So he really didn't need my guidance on how to read a lion's behavior to approximate towards a voluntary injection. It was the reinforcing the behavior of doing well and, you know, helping share, having that shared experience too, that, you know, he would see something and agreeing with it, and not just to agree, but because that's exactly right. So I think, you know, having that shared experience is sometimes all it takes, yeah, to unlock in someone what was already existing there.
Beautiful. I promised myself that I'd only ask one question on that story. So moving on, number three.
Well, you did a good job of it. I will reinforce that step for you. You
only asked one question. I'm going to ask one question more often in the future now. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah. Well, okay, so number three. I already mentioned the heritage farm, and I think that is really important to my story, because I also didn't really know what the culture of, you know, what the various cultures of New Mexico were coming in, whether you're looking at it based on people or professional occupations. And so in New Mexico, there is a huge ranching culture here. And so I didn't exactly understand the parallels that would occur at our heritage farm to, you know, the experiences our keepers and our farmers there have with their outside life in, you know, being on ranches and working with livestock and a lot of these same kinds of heritage species. And so when I came in, you know, I think the idea of doing anything, you know, there's a lot of procedures that exist for livestock, and I don't need to detail what those are, I don't think. But there's a lot of predispositions on how things are handled, how animal procedures go. And so to reverse the thinking on that seemed a little monumental, you know, in the beginning, because the idea of training voluntary hoof, you know, hoof inspection and picks and hoof trims, that kind of thing with our sheep, that just wasn't a concept that even exists in our grander culture here in New Mexico. And so, again, it was just starting with the little things. And so we started with the chickens, because there's a couple flocks of chickens there. And I definitely have to say Steve Martin, he had a big influence on this this decision too, because he would talk about how much I love chickens, because that is very true. I do love chickens, and I've worked with a lot of chickens in my time. But so the Heritage Farm, that was where we started, was, okay, let's just work with the chickens, not even go beyond, you know, anyone else's, not go beyond to the horses or the steer yet, the sheep yet, because the chickens are something that there aren't nearly as many notions about what can and can't be done with them. And so we worked with these flocks of chickens to not only kind of, you know, do different various runs around the farmyard out of their coop. So, you know, showing guests, you know, what they were capable of, but also the team ended up deciding to build this really cool mobile coop for them that could be hooked up to a trailer that then we could take to anywhere in the Heritage Farm area, which is, I believe it's 3 or 4 acres. So it's a very large area. This mobile coop could be put out and the chickens could be led out to there. And then they could have the experience of every day being kind of in a new environment around the heritage farm while also showcasing to guests, but more importantly, the farmers, what these chickens were capable of. And I think anyone who sees a chicken, you know, doing anything involving positive reinforcement usually has their mind blown the first time, because we all have thoughts about what chickens are, you know, what they're capable of. And so I think for the team, that was really important to see, wow, the, you know, how quickly the chickens could learn, how they could start to pick up on the body language of these animals. And then that led the team back to the steer and the sheep and the horses. And they were the ones that brought us back to thinking about, okay, well, how could we maybe approach a hoof trim voluntarily? And so it was very, they were very apprehensive at first. And again, it's about those approximations, right? So not about, okay, we're going to change everything to being, you know, exactly voluntary at first, but working at the approximation. So let's work on the hoof trims first. And then let's add in the shearing experience our sheep have. And let's add in every layer of their care that we possibly can until we have created this whole new voluntary positive reinforcement repertoire for the animals. And the reason this is so powerful, and I'm getting to it, is that now we have the same team that existed 2.5 years ago, but in this last year, we've received 2 new cattle. We've received 6 new sheep, as well as 2 new flocks of chickens. And I didn't even have to do any real prompting even to encourage the first discussion on what training for those animals looked like. And so you'd asked about, you know, my outlook on my job and learning. And I think this is the perfect example of my job becoming arbitrary or, you know, obsolete, that I didn't even need to encourage the farm team to think about the way these animals, their care could occur in the best way possible because of those small approximations we took back in the beginning. And to see the difference, not only just for those animals and that team, but then to think of it in the grander scheme of New Mexico as a ranching farming state, and the fact that all of those farmers who work on our farm also go back to their own farms or their own houses where they have some form of livestock, that, you know, the effects we have, you know, we have ripple effects on things. And so, you know, because these, you know, this select group, this set of animals at the heritage farm is now receiving this voluntary care, they have affected the animals that these farmers have at home. And in turn, that affects everyone in their lives. So I just love the way we can affect our communities too, beyond just the lives of our animals and the people in front of us.
Yeah, I feel like that's a really important part of the zoo community in 2021. You talked then about the effect you're having, and I love your language. You're so ATA, Tim. You changed that to ripples. And that brings me to my one question, although we do have competing reinforcers. We're going to talk about that in a second. My one question for this story is, as your choice of language, you also said the team asked the question, how could we maybe, like the way that I think there is such value in the way that word is questioned. How could we maybe? Is what I'm saying resonating with you? You're nodding your head. People can't see it, but Tim's nodding his head, everyone. Is it making sense? Is the way you word things, both internally and externally, important for how you operate?
For me, yes. That is, I think, an extreme tenet of who I am. And you know, I think it does come from working for the Disney company and being on stage, is that, you know, words are powerful. And I'm interested that you picked up on that specifically, because yeah, the wording there was very specific. That is how, you know, maybe it wasn't those exact words, but the phrasing, what was behind it, is how they asked it. It wasn't a blatant, oh yeah, let's go do this. It was a kind of, okay, we're ready to entertain this idea. you know, don't know if we're ready to actually approach it, you know, embody it yet, but we're ready to at least entertain the idea. And that's all you need. You know, you don't need people to be ready to jump in 24/7 to what you're asking of them or what you're saying should happen. I think those people who are approaching it slowly, they're often the ones that kind of have the most long-term success in a way, because they're learning it from the ground up and they're experiencing it for themselves. And that's something that, you know, if you read a book all about behavior, you're not going to get, is seeing an animal in front of you implementing something and watching the change happen, watching the learning happen. And so I love when people approach me with those could we maybes, because I like to turn those into how do we do this? You know, how do we take this and actually make it a reality, but using the person's interest.
This episode will be called Could We Maybes? That is an actual thing. Hey, you said that question's all you need. That, and I feel like that is just generating that question, just having a team that are asking those questions is an approximation worthy of celebrating, which flows really nicely with, I think, the whole feel of this podcast episode. And I'm really curious, you talked about your time at Disney being important for the words you use and your time on stage. I'm sure your time and the other organizations you've worked for as well. This ability to be able to break down not only your learners, your non-human learners' behavior when you're trying to teach them something new, but also how you operate as a human with other human learners in a team environment and one-on-one as well. Where did that come from? Is that who you are? Is that in your DNA? Or is that to break down learning for yourself and other human learners something that was taught to you, and where and how did you learn this?
Wow. Are we going to spend another hour talking about this question, yeah, Ryan?
This is where I have competing reinforcers, because I was reinforced by you saying, hey, well done, Ryan, and asking one question. But then I think I'm more reinforced by hearing people's answers from multiple questions. Sorry for the competing reinforcers, everyone.
Yeah, I mean, you did ask one question. It was just one kind of long
run. No, I asked two. Because the first one was about words.
Yeah. So
in five words, answer that question. No, where did this ability to look at, like, everything you're saying, like everything you look at is like, can I break down today into seconds? Like you were sharing that earlier. And for your keeper that you had believe in and you reinforce, you know, what is it that we can celebrate now that's already inside this person? I'm just thinking about just then that idea of, even though we might not be sold on an idea, the approximation of even asking a question like, could we maybe, is worthy of celebrating. And for me, it's only really something that I've developed and we've developed as a community at Animal Training Academy over the last years, helped a lot by Susan Freeman, Sarah Owings, and many other members of our community. But I'm wondering for you, how did this evolve to be such, and maybe you don't label yourself as this, but it's clear and evident through your stories and everything you're sharing with us today that it is. It's bled into everything. Where did that come from?
It's interesting the way you've I don't think anyone has ever asked me this question this specifically, so I'm having to do a little bit of processing myself. But I think if I can pinpoint at least one variable, it's my family again. And I grew up with lots of cousins and lots of aunts and uncles and grandmas and grandpas who all lived very close to each other, were always at each other's houses. And we always would be around each other, whether we were happy or mad at each other for whatever reason. And so I think from a very young age, the desire to have the best relationship with everyone around me in a very authentic way, that was something I know my mom and dad also fostered in me, but also just it kind of had to happen because we were spending so much time around all of these different people who are all very different from each other, even though we are family. You kind of have the option. Do you want to just forge your own way and kind of blunder past all these people, not caring how you affect them or what your interactions are, or to really hone in on the way you interact with people and leave them better than you met them. And I believe in that phrase hugely, whether it's, again, a 1 second, a 5 second interaction, or for the long term, you know, in a year's type span. So I think the desire to improve relationships constantly, that just came from this innate family value I had. But then because I had this love for animals and I met other people who then were kind of putting into action what I had grown up with, I didn't ever know those things existed until I again met the community I have. Did I manage to answer both your questions?
No, just joking. No. The answer was perfect because it came from you. And yes, you did answer both of those questions, and I'm grateful for that. I'm gonna stop talking now. I'm gonna ask no questions.
No more questions.
And ask you to share number 4 and 5 with us.
Yep, numbers 4 and 5. So number 4 is thinking about our giraffe program and the giraffe we have at the zoo. I again came into a situation where the setup had been designed for these animals such that there wasn't a need necessarily for positive reinforcement-based training, right? So using certain, anyone who's familiar with a zoological setting knows, you know, restraint devices and chutes and things like that. So they're eliminated really the need to have any kind of trust-based relationship with these animals. And so I was really lucky to come into the biopark at a time where there were two keepers in the area who didn't know what they wanted from the giraffe beyond a better relationship with them, beyond just being able to walk up to the enclosure and have the giraffe want to come over to them and to interact with them and to have positive interactions with them versus neutral to negative. And having that kind of raw desire, that was pretty cool for me because, you know, I think that they were learners where it didn't take too much to really spark that interest in them again. But since all they really wanted was just some kind of positive interaction with those animals. And, you know, if anyone has worked with an animal who's lived a long amount of time not having the experience of being a positive reinforcement-based learner, it can be a slow process to introduce an animal to what that looks like, that their behavior has meaning. And with these giraffes, it was an extremely slow process because, again, we were reflective of the kind of carnivore cat conversation. We were using very old facilities that weren't necessarily designed for these types of interactions. But so it took a lot of creativity and a lot of patience and a lot of use of spaces that previously hadn't had great connotations for these animals, overriding all of those things and coming to have just this basic relationship with these giraffes where they'd come over to the keepers. That moment alone, I mean, I remember both of the keepers turning around the first time the whole herd chose to come over to them just by calling, the tears in their eyes. I mean, you know, you don't need to see the tears, but the physical expression of the emotion of that moment for those two keepers was so powerful. And then now the way that's expressed in the giraffe is, I mean, I love it because the giraffe, in a sense, demand training now, demand these interactions. You see these moments where the giraffe are soliciting for attention, soliciting for interaction and training. And it's just, again, such a stark change from where they were 3 years ago. And then hopefully, you know, we've been lucky enough to have a couple baby giraffe in the last 2 years who have gone off to other facilities. That hopefully that focus on building relationships with these giraffe transcends to those other places, to other people, and to their relationships they're able to build with the animals that came from us.
We call those ripples. I have no questions, Tim. That's a lie. I have a ton of questions, but I'm not going to ask them in the interest of time.
Yeah.
Number 5.
No, number 5. So number 5, I'm going to tell you is kind of, I wanted to give an example of kind of a work in progress, but it's an exciting work in progress for us. And it's with our, naked mole rats, which, for those of you who maybe don't know what the naked mole rat experience is, we have several colonies. So it's groups of naked mole rats with a queen, and then the other rats that exist within that colony. We have three of these colonies in our collection that are not connected to each other. And they, a colony actually is a series of kind of tubes and chambers that mirror what their underground existence would look like. But all of those chambers are contained, and naked mole rats are blind. So I think they're another animal that it would be very easy, or it is very easy, to potentially kind of write off as, you know, existing in the way that they do with no need for anything beyond the basic level of care we think we understand for them. That being said, their keeper was someone who had accepted that that was the view on them, both, you know, within our facility, but then I think that's kind of countrywide. Places that have these animals don't necessarily always foster this kind of understanding of them. But their keeper had accepted that was kind of the view on the naked mole rats, but also had something in her that said, no, we need to be doing more for them. And so again, it was latching on to the moment she told me why I, you know, this is what people say about them, but this is what I want. A could we maybe type moment, you know, what could we maybe do for them to change what people think about them? And it's not, you know, it was not formal training, but what we did take on, you know, you think of the hierarchy of behavior change. We looked at kind of all the antecedents that we could control in the colony, which luckily are everything, right? Because it is a closed colony, we could literally control almost any antecedent that these animals were experiencing. And so she started introducing all different forms of natural vegetation enrichment, whether it was tubers and roots that they could eat or chew on and explore, to different fresh herbs. And that, you know, she, I think, has been doing that now for about 6 months. And she gives me this recap every week of what happens. And I always call it, you know, how the naked mole rat turns, because she always has the drama that is associated now with all of a sudden these interactions she started to see between all of the animals within the colony, and what situations she can kind of create by putting different forms of enrichment into their environment. And the kind of amazing thing that we still, you know, we don't have the empirical proof, but in the last couple of years, we have not been able to successfully have any pups born to any of our colonies. And without really knowing why that was happening, we had pups born, but they weren't successfully reared, and not really any knowledge, even from other places that we could get, as to why that might be. In the last month, we now have a successful litter of naked mole rat pups, and that's the first time that has ever, again, happened in recent memory here at the biopark. And when you think about what has been changed in their environment, the only thing that has been changed is the addition of these different enrichment items. And that is just so amazing to me that, you know, I think it's, we categorize things. We think of enrichment, you know, which we can talk all about what enrichment is in itself, but I think a lot of people think of it as, you know, an item or a toy or something, but really it's about affecting our animals' lives and changing behavior in a way that will positively influence them. And so even just this simple change in mindset, the shift in thought away from what the majority was saying is all it took to now be in this kind of amazing situation where, you know, our naked mole rat colony is flourishing in a whole new way that we hadn't even fathomed was possible when we kind of set out on this journey to just see what could we do to help modify their behavior and build their behavior.
Always celebrating more nakedness. This is not a question. It's just a statement. I love the relation to the hierarchy. It's a statement, but feel free to build on it. I love the relation to the hierarchy, and I love this story and how it reminds us that we don't always need to go in and train. We can just make sure environments are optimal and behavior flows from that. It's beautiful. Wrapping up, yeah. Though, thank you for not building on it, because that would go. Yes, is the perfect response. Let's head sadly, because I'm loving this, but let's head sadly to our final questions. And we always ask people, we started off with you as a young young Tim with your family and kind of the environment that fostered who you are now today. But we're interested in moving into the future now and what you really want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in with animal training, with positive reinforcement.
Yeah, I think we all exist in silos of some form. We, you know, we separate ourselves out for whatever reason or for whatever situation. And in my mind, I'm specifically thinking about, you know, in the animal training community and what I experience on a daily basis. And so I see people really easily starting to come to the idea of why positive reinforcement is so necessary for our animals' care, for helping them have the best lives, for empowering them to be their best natural selves. But I sometimes see people who are so great at that concept not translating it to the people they work with and the people in their environment. And so I think if I could set a direction and a goal for where positive reinforcement training is going to go in the next 5 to 10 years, it's that people will come to see the universality of it, you know, and that's something I still experience sometimes on a daily basis at the biopark, is people telling me, well, you're just the bird person, you're just a macaw person, or you're not a blank person, you're not a marmoset person, or whatever it might be. But at the end of the day, I think we all, especially here at, you know, ATA, we have the understanding that behavior is universal, and that applies not only within the animal world, but to our human world and our human interactions. And so I love that that's something you pulled out from what I was saying, even though it wasn't necessarily the focus of it, is just fostering relationships and treating relationships just as preciously as we do our relationships with our animals. And understanding that the things that motivate our behavior are exactly the same as our animals. And that if we can learn to find what drives our coworkers, our companions, our family's behavior, that's how we are going to have the best lives possible with those people, and not in any manipulative way. You know, because I think that's sometimes where the line people can draw with, oh, well, that's animals, that's people, is that people see it maybe as manipulation when they understand others better. But isn't that what our whole human experience is about, is understanding others, understanding animals, understanding the world around us better? And so why not take the concepts of behavior change and see the way that they influence everything around us? I think when people are able to do that, when they're able to see the way reinforcers and behavior reinforcers affect everyone in our lives, that's when they, you know, we'll have a true understanding of how we can all be our best selves. You know, I've spent a lot of time talking about empowering our animals to be their best selves, but we also deserve to be our best selves and to be surrounded by people who are the best versions of themselves. So in the end, yeah, I just hope we all can realize how we all deserve to, we deserve the same things we are giving to our animals.
Well, hey, feel like I may label air quotes, saying very loosely, better person now than I was 2 hours ago. Your energy, enthusiasm, understanding, and practical application of the science, Tim, is evident. And I think it's going to be evident to everyone listening to this episode today. Luckily, you and I are going to connect again in a month's time. We're going to be joined by Susan Friedman, Dr. Chrissy Alligood, Rick Hurst, Ava Bertelsen, who I mentioned earlier, Tim. So it's nice to tie that together in a panel discussion within the ATA membership next month. We'll be sending out information about that to everyone. Luckily, us in the ATA community now have Tim, and we're never going to let him go. So we get to continue to benefit from his presence, the antecedent of having him in our community. But for those who are just part of the podcast audience and haven't joined the membership yet, once again, where can they go? Can you remind us to find you online, Tim, and to follow along, watch your Vitamin Z series? Can you just remind everyone where the best places are to find you online?
Yeah, of course. Facebook is probably going to be the best place. You can find me under my name, Tim Van Loan. And then, of course, the ABQ Biopark and New Mexico Biopark Society have pages on Facebook. And then YouTube would be a great place to go type in vitamin Z elephants and see what pops up. You know, you might actually get to see what my smile looks like if you go click on that video. So
I highly recommend it. And we will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes as well. Tim, this has been so much fun from myself and on behalf of everyone listening. Once again, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us today.
No, thank you so much, Ryan. It's been such a pleasure. And I am excited to connect with you and the ATA community even further beyond this podcast. So thanks for your time.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.